At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
It was broad daylight. It was a Saturday afternoon on one of the busiest trails in one of Arkansas's most beloved state parks, Devil's Den. Ominous, but very welcoming for many people for many years. Clinton and Kristen Brink, who are new to the area, just settling their lives in the outskirts of Fayetteville in a small town named Prairie Grove. They were hiking with their two young daughters. Then, in a matter of seconds, that ordinary afternoon became a nightmare. The Brinks were stabbed to death right there on the trail. Well, after 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny Saturday, their daughters, aged 7 and 9, ran for their lives after their mother screamed, "Run as far and fast as you can." They survived, but what they witnessed will never leave them. And the man who did this, as of this recording, he's still out there. His case isn't just disturbing, it's calculated. He came prepared, dark clothing, fingerless gloves, an oversized gear bag, and a license plate taped over. A witness described him exclusively here on the Hidden Killers podcast as walking like he was on a mission. And the level of precision here tells us something. This wasn't random chaos. This was behavioral design. So today, we're turning to someone who knows how to read between the bloodlines. Joining me is a man who spent his career decoding the minds of some of the most dangerous threats out there to America, retired FBI special agent and former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit. We're going to break down the case piece by piece, from the psychology of the suspect to the nightmare left behind, to how hikers like this think, plan, and sometimes slip up. If you're following the case, this is a conversation you need to hear. So let's get into it, Robin Drake. A lot of people, many witnesses, have said the man gave them a death stare. And the folks that I talked to here on the program on Sunday, about 24 hours after this went down, said exactly that. Scanned them up and down in silence. Gave them a very dark feeling, bad energy, is how all four of them described it. But they moved on with their day. This is before knowing this man was going to go and stab a family on the trail just a few meters up ahead. This is the feeling they had, very visceral, as they had that small interaction with him. From a behavioral assessment lens, what do you get out of this? What type of fixed, silent gaze, what does that indicate with someone who's acting like that in an otherwise very peaceful environment?
First of all, Tony, I want to commend you for the work you've done on this case so far. Hands down, from all the cases we've covered in the last 3 years together, this is the best you've done. And I've actually tracking what's going on with the case, not with other outlets, but with you. And so with that, yeah, so we're getting a lot of data points, but no conclusions yet. And so when you, let's break it down. So this stare that everyone's saying they're getting, what people are doing in these situations, in every situation in life, and it's playing out here, and it tells us a lot about that mindset, is we're assessing our environment for threats. And so my, through a conjecture, obviously, because we don't know who this individual is, but as someone who's very obviously on a mission, very determined to do something nefarious and not good as he's assaulting this couple and ultimately killing them, as he's moving towards that target, he's literally assessing threats, the safety, his safety. And so he's assessing, is this a threat? Is this a threat? Is this a threat? So as he's mission focused, which makes him look incredibly incongruent with the environment because everyone else there is there for enjoyment, to be out in nature, to spend time with family. His objectives are completely incongruent with that. So he's going to look very different from that. And then as he's moving, he's going to constantly take in the environment for any threats to his safety before he executes the horrible crime he did.
That's an interesting take on it, because when I was initially looking at this and I heard that, you know, in real time with the hikers, what ran through my mind was he sizing them up? And in a way he was, certainly to assess if they were a threat to him, but was he also in the process of sizing up could this be my target? Because the big question that a lot of people are raising here, you know, was this premeditated? What premeditated? Was this planned? I think the answer to that is a clear yes, but was it targeted? Or was he trying to pick his target as he went along the trail? That's why he had such the intense stare at the couple that we talked to and others who were out there on the trail that also witnessed this guy.
So it's a data point we don't know. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to assess whether it was targeted towards that couple in particular or anyone else, like he like went out to purpose, in other words, to kill someone, mm-hmm. and he's going to find a target, or is he targeted to them in particular? We would need to take a look at the people that he did interact with and see what that dynamic looks like. The reason why I'm kind of moving away from that potentiality doesn't mean it's not truth, but the probability of it being lower is only because out of the couple that he targeted, he attacked the male first. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going for an easier target for a male to kill, if he's there to kill anyone in general, would not you kill the female first? Another group that's out there, maybe there's two females that he encountered, which I think he did. You know, so in other words, if you're going for an easier target selection for the mere fact of, well, I want to kill someone today in this location, I would think that there'd be other targets that would look very similar or potentially even easier than a group of four. So that's why I always caveat it, I look at the laws of probability first so we can outrule things, mm-hmm. and move on to something else if that's not the case. So I always go down the laws of probability first.
And it was a group before that he attacked, but two of them were small children. And the other group was four adults that we had talked to. So mm-hmm. that I could see very much. Yeah, maybe he knew he was not going to outmaneuver four adults. He wore all black, fingerless gloves. Again, remember, this is a 100-degree day, about 104 with the heat index. It was hot out. All black, pants, shirt. We've seen the image now that has been put out by law enforcement of the man. This is what he looks like. It's a shot of the back. But he is, it's hot. That would be a lot to wear. That would be a lot to go. How does the physical presentation choices like this, inform what the heck he was doing? And as far as threat profiling, why was he out there wearing all of this? Obviously, it seems he was on this mission, but it certainly stands out. If you're trying to go incognito or not get caught, I don't think that was on his radar at all.
So, again, I'm going to go loss of probability here. It's hard to assess how smart or not smart he was in doing this. There's a lot of dumb things he did, mm-hmm. But as well as thoughtful things. So to be covered up like that, I mean, just think back to the Koberger case too, completely covered up. And now we don't have any evidence of blood splatter anywhere. So if he's got an intent, he's got a knife, he's going to have blood splatter. He's going to cover himself from head to toe so there's no DNA evidence on it. He's going to take it off himself, secrete it in that big ass bag he's got, and dump it someplace. So what I'd be doing right now, I'd be looking for that bag.
I wonder if he still has the bag. I mean, we still haven't found him. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that could very well be a possibility if you did commit the crime and you're trying to get rid of whatever you're going to get rid of. That bag would hold a hell of a lot more than a knife, though.
Because it looks empty right there.
Yeah.
And so why would you have such a large bag? Why would you have any bag at all unless mm-hmm. you plan on using a bag for something? And so you look at the volume of clothing he has. Like you said, you look at the hot day. What would the other be? What would be the reason mm-hmm. to have a large bag? So I'm going to put something in the bag. What am I going to put in the bag? Probably the clothes that I'm worried about going to be blood splattered all over me.
Without a doubt. I mean, one of the big things that also was noted, because there has been some conflicting reports on what he was wearing as a top. Mm-hmm. And there was two times where eyewitnesses saw him before the murder and after. We have not conclusively narrowed this down yet. So the only assumption I can make on this between the descriptions of what he was wearing initially, it's that black shirt. People have even identified that very shirt now. I've gotten screenshots of it because there's a little piece in the back of a graphic that you can see. Others right. have now identified what that shirt is and where you can buy it down to a T, which I thought was very impressive. But allegedly, some saw him in a tank top at some point. I'm right. going to guess maybe after the killings took place, he took that thing off. Maybe that's the reason for the heavy, heavy clothing was to get whatever he was going to get on that and then dispose of it.
I'm going on that because, again, all we do in situations where we have a lot of unknowns is you start just going down and ticking down the laws of probability so you can either rule that in or rule it out. So I'm right now, I'm going with the laws of probability of him using that as cover for blood splatter to secrete it in the bag and get rid of it as a possibility. So the first thing we now do is, all right, so let's look for the bag. And then we're going to be examining routes he was on. We're going to be looking at a lot of things. And then we start looking at, like you said, some saw him in a tank top, some didn't see him in a tank top. So now we're have a potential for inconsistency of his presentation, which shows a little bit of chaos. Maybe he was determined and had some grit until faced with the weather itself. And so he's getting lazy. So I see from not just this, but also other some data points there. Here's someone who actually had a plan, but not a super well thought out plan, but good enough to do this and get away with it for a while. But what we also have is we have a ton of leakage of there's tons of witnesses that saw him, saw the vehicle. So that's that to me says not as thankfully not as well planned out as someone could have done this.
And that's what makes a lot of this case very intriguing and scary for locals is, was this man on a mission to go after this specific family, that specific man, that specific couple? And the way he did it, he didn't yell, he didn't speak, he didn't lash out, he just executed. Then right. He walked away. What sort of clues does that give us in terms of underlying motive? Number one, it's a knife, which is a very intimate thing to use, but a right. gun would certainly bring a lot of attention to a busy state park on a Saturday afternoon, so that might explain the choice of weaponry. But based on this behavior, is this someone, you know, is he operating under a fantasy, you know, delusional out there thinking that this is someone he needs to kill because they're a threat or whatever, a personal grievance, a power mission? Obviously, we're so early in this investigation, and we don't even know who the man is as of this recording, but how does this read to you in terms of just the actions that he took?
Yeah, first of all, broken brain, hands down. You know, taking actions like he did, you know, we got someone who's got a really broken brain. So moving my non-scientific assessment aside of that, what we do in cases like this is, and what you and I do is, so let's look at the laws of probability and take the only few data points we have and do a deep dive on those to see if we can rule them out, because you don't want to say, oh, it's definitely this, because you can be wrong, mm-hmm. but you at least want to do a deep enough dive to rule it out. So in cases like this, and matter of fact, you and I were going back and forth on this as soon as it broke. And the first things that pop into my mind is things that you and I have seen before on cases like this. My first question is he divorced? Is there a child custody issue going on? Because typically if we see something that semblances like a hit, like it might be a hit, we've have reps in that there's a lot of times some child custody. And so we did a deeper dive, is it former marriages? And it looks clean on that slate.
It does, yeah.
And in, I don't remember the exact number. We're talking about 95 to 98% of the cases, the individual is known, maybe not by the individual receiving the violence, but known to the individual committing the violence. You know, Koberger is a great example. The girls might not have known Koberger, but Koberger definitely knew of at least Maddie, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so we now have to look at how could we, this individual possibly have some sort of connection with those two or at least one. And the only other data points you start getting in is recently moved from another location. So that's an interesting data point of a murder that happens after a recent move. And then the only thing I started looking at again, because the only thing we have is place of employment. And he stuck with the same company, it looks like, and he took a transfer to another location for a milk delivery company. Mm-hmm. So the only other data point you start exploring to try to flush out is workplace issues, people in his life issues, you know, and that's what law enforcement is going to do. He's got a very limited internet footprint. So is the wife. So I'm doing my best to flush out and eliminate as a possibility or maybe a confirmation that it's somehow someone related to him in his life that's got some sort of grievance. And I say him for this reason. And it might be, like I said, unbeknownst, because all we other have now, too, is what was reported by the daughters of the things that the wife said, because he said nothing, is, and then you reported this, mm-hmm. why are you doing this, is what the wife said.
Yeah.
And so those words give me some clues that even if she was aware of who this individual was, she didn't know why he was taking the actions he was. So if that's the case, and he's going after the husbands first, there's some grievance potentially as a potential data point to flesh out between that this individual had with the husband that the wife was unaware of. So there's some sort of potentiality of there that I want to flesh out as much as I can. That's why I'm giving long explanations to, they just got to do a lot of interviews. They got to talk to a lot of people that were who knew these people, knew them at work, the move, what spurred the move. And then when you're doing these deeper dives on these interviews of people that are around them in their lives, here's what you're looking for. Who wasn't happy to see you when you showed up at work? Who was silent? You know, when you sat in a meeting, was there anyone that was in that meeting that just seemed off, that didn't seem to be completely pleased? I mean, so we're looking for a spike in the norm from a population that's in your life, a spike in the norm of an individual, one, two, and then that's where you not now need to start focusing against. Because what you're doing along the process here is you're creating filters. All right, I can eliminate this group, I can eliminate this situation, I can eliminate this place of employment or not. So you're just creating filters as you go down, trying to see if this individual was connected in some way from the individual's perspective, not the victim's perspective, because he may or may not be aware of the wrong from the murderer's viewpoint. So you just want to do that. You want to flush out who in his life might have been potential, so you can interview, figure it out.
Yeah, and that leaves us with so many questions, especially that, like you said, that why are you doing this? Because I try to, you try to put yourself in that situation for just a second and go, okay, if this was happening to me, and I mean, it's a very hard one to do unless you're actually there in that moment in time to know what exactly one would be thinking if this is happening. And I don't know if I personally would be yelling, why are you doing this? I think there would be a lot of stop. I think there'd be a lot of, almost trying to attack the attacker. And I'm in no way, shape, or form trying to criticize his mom whatsoever. I am not. I'm just trying to figure out why are you doing this? Because that does seem a little intimate. It intimates somewhat of a personal, or at least an identification possibly, of who that person is. I could be completely wrong. It could just be what was uttered out of her mouth in a moment of utter chaos and shock and trauma.
Right.
Or it could lead to something. The kids, obviously, as we learned here exclusively, that they said to the dispatcher they thought it was a stranger. They didn't know who this was. Mm-hmm. The most heartbreaking line of all of that from the dispatcher who we talked to was the fact that the children said that they ran until they couldn't hear their mother's cries anymore.
Right.
And thankfully, they were taken up by a good Samaritan who was on the trail and got them to the ranger station to which they called 911. But what does it mean when a killer leaves the children alive but executes the parents without a word? Quite often, you see things like this where they're going to take out the parents and then try and get the kids. It seems the kids might have been an afterthought here because he didn't chase after them. He took out the parents and then left the park, basically, in quite a rush.
Or he's incapable of chasing the kids again without the context of being there. Yeah. It sounds like they did a good job of getting away as he's preoccupied. I mean, so when you're attacking someone who doesn't want to be attacked with a knife, it's going to take a few minutes, especially if you're upright, you're moving, he's defending himself. You have a wife that's most likely just not being a bystander, is probably trying to get him off her, I mean, off her husband, as you're then screaming at the kids. And so there's a lot of moving parts there, and it takes a lot of energy on someone on a hot day, overdressed, heat, sweating, and all that. So as the kids are moving fast and with a purpose out of fear, you know, fight or flight's kicking in, his ability to then chase them down. At that point, you're now aware of, he might be more aware of what's going on in the environment. So he's now in getaway mode. Mm-hmm. The fact he's not saying anything, he was very clear in his mind what he was going to do and his reasoning for do it, because he's not responding to the inquiry. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? You know, so it wasn't, it just makes it very curious. And again, like we said, you, from that statement alone, you can't determine whether she, at least I can't from thinking hard about this, whether she knew him or didn't know him, but she definitely was not aware of the reason for the interaction. The fact that the kids didn't recognize him, I'm not taking that as anything except, all right, so he's not an intimate family connection. It might be just, like you said, a work connection that his wife might be aware of or unaware of. I tried to place myself in our good active empathy role that we sometimes do of what would I have said, what some of the things you could have said in that situation is, and that the other thing that came to mind besides why are you doing this is we can talk about this. You know, so which would give an intimation of she had a clue about what this might have been about. But my first impression from that statement is I don't think she's aware, whether she's aware of who he is or not, she's not aware of the reason for his actions.
Yeah.
Again, that's what we call a wag, a wild ass guess.
The technical term of it, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I'm thinking that's what my head is kind of saying on this one.
And the other interesting note here is he had not started his job yet here. He was about to start on Monday of this week. He had not been employed. So it really doesn't make room for, you know, angry coworkers or anything of that because he had not yet interacted locally here. But we do know he worked for another, I believe from what I understand, and I cannot confirm it, I believe it was the same company in Montana. This is a subsidiary here that he had been transferred to. It wasn't necessarily, as far as we understand, a promotion, but more of a lateral move. And why they wanted to come here, we do not know the answer to that question as of yet. But that's another factor in here. Montana's a long ways away from Northwest Arkansas. So if you got a grudge from some your coworker or whatever, we're talking like, you know, 14 to 20 hour trip if you're going to drive this to get down here and target out your man. We are a very big hiking community, very outdoorsy, which, you know, a lot of Montana is as well. So I guess you do have somewhat of a connection there. If there is, this is someone from the past that would be familiar with the outdoors or able to navigate it a bit, if that's from the area that they're from. But we still don't know the answers to either of those questions as of yet.
Yeah, and I've been trying to do, as you and I have talked beforehand too, I've been trying to do a deep dive of the company itself to kind of see, again, what kind of spiking, what might be a data point we can kind of zero in on. Not getting much. Except, you know, I did read, again, it's very light, you know, that there's potential employment issues with people being laid off in the past. Again, so moving from another location, taking up a job here, if there's a probability or possibility of it being work-related, the only thing that's really popping in my mind is a possibility to explore would be, did he bump someone else out of a job when he showed up that was expecting to start work that he took the job place of, and someone goes from 0 to 100 with, you know, horrible problem solving skills to take care of it or prevent, you know, so there's, again, you're not getting a lot of data, but when I did a deep dive on the company with the only data point we have, you know, the only thing I'm coming up with is a possibility to not say it is, but to rule out is that, someplace not personally, but the individual might have known of this guy taking his position he wanted or was applying for, so he's angry.
That's an interesting look. Yeah, I mean, I've been in those sort of situations. I think we all maybe have at some point in time where you get the job, somebody that wanted it didn't get it, and yeah, they're angry. I've never been in a situation where I'm fearing they're going to stalk me down on a day I'm hiking with my family, but there's some nuts out there that could certainly go that far. It just leaves so many questions, and it's a lot of conjecture. And I want to say this because a lot of the reporting that we've done here has come from you guys out there who've reached out and said, hey, I know this, and here's how, and here's why, and we've been able to verify and go with it. So we're not trying to speculate or spread rumors or anything like that. This is all just conjecture as we try to break this down. But if anyone does have conclusive answers to any of this and can help us right the ship or just define the path of the map that we're going on. And that would be extremely helpful. You can certainly contact us. True Crime Today Pod is where you can find us and you can give us your feedback. There's a contact us and give us some insight if you're able to correct anything. Because right now it is fog of war. This is very early on in this investigation. And the last thing I tell you I want to do here is be saying things that are somebody's going to run with and go, this must be true. Because obviously none of this we're saying is fact. So the sooner we can get to fact here and present that to the audience, to you guys, the better. So anybody who knows any of the answers to this question, we would love to hear from you.
Because, and as you said, Tony, and just flesh that a little bit more too, and that's why I was really careful at the very beginning, is to rule out the data points we have by fleshing out the probabilities of things. And so the more data points you have, which is observations, thoughts, opinions, but really facts and data details, it helps us keep painting that picture. And right now we have so little that you don't, that you go into the conjecture world, not to say what it is, but to try to rule out what it isn't. And so, because again, when you don't have much, all you can do is look on past experience, probabilities, to say it, there's a possibility from past experience this could be it. So let's do all we can to rule that out so we can move on to something else, or we'll flesh out it actually is that.
I agree. So again, if anybody has any information, truecrimetodaypod.com is a website. Go to contact us. You can reach out that way. That's probably one of the easiest, or through any of our social media channels. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and send me a direct message and let me know, and we can conversate off the air about anything that you may know. Let's talk about this angle of it. Based on what we know, this man, he executed, he fled immediately, and as far as we know as of right now, has not resurfaced. By the time you're watching this, there may be some more developments. What does it tell you about his psychological state post-crime? He got out of there in a hurry. People in that park, that's how they identified there's something off with this guy. Some even said that they saw blood on him, and it's been very gray fog of war area to say where that blood was. Was it on his hands? Did he cut himself? Right. That's kind of up in the air. Or was it the victim's blood? But he sped out of there as fast as he could. The video that we obtained here exclusively at True Crime Today shows him speeding out of the park. That dash cam or that that security footage shows a residence just outside of the park going about 60 to 70 miles an hour straight out of there. And then others also reporting a very somewhat erratic or speeding driver in the area at that point in time. What does that say about this? Is him fleeing in that sort of manner? If you're, I don't know, if you're going to carry out an attack like this, again, I would think you're going to be not wanting to stand out, but obviously that was not on his list from the very beginning before the attacks either, with his clothing.
Low reps. That's the only thing that really strikes me, is he's got low reps in doing this type of thing. And two reasons. One, it looks like an extremely distinctive car with its look, its sound. I mean, the fact that people can really recall exactly what they heard and saw with the vehicle says a lot. Putting tape over the license plate is a very, very rudimentary, basic, but effective thing so far, because they weren't able to run a license plate and get a name ID off of it. But here's the other thing I'm thinking of too with that is, all right, so if he had committed any kind of crimes in the past where he's got a lengthy or even a substantial rap sheet, or even a one or two off rap sheet, that car is going to be very distinctive to him, and cops are going to be able to zero it in on, especially if he's local in any sort of way, small areas, small departments, not a whole lot of sworn. So they're going to be able to recognize that car regardless if it had been on their radar in the past. And so most likely, again, if he's thinking, he's thinking that, you know, he wasn't thinking much about that car. And so, because the car hasn't been an issue for him in the past, which means he most likely hasn't done something to this scale. He might have a rap sheet, because it's hard to go from zero to 100, zero to murder. But nothing that's ever involved his vehicle before, but if it has, which is a probability, boy, that was a really stupid move to use that same car to do exactly this. His speed, again, that goes towards that low reps. You know, you don't want to stand out any more than you have, but he was fleeing for, he hit fight or flight after this, no doubt.
And what I wonder about with this, because, you know, zero to 100, this is 100. To be taking out a mom and a dad in the middle of the day on a very, very busy hiking trail. This is one of the busiest in the state. People come from all over the general area here in the Midwest, from Missouri to Kansas to anywhere in this general vicinity, to hike this trail because of its beauty. It's just a very well-known place to be. I've hiked it myself with my daughter, and it's a really neat place to be. And again, middle of summer, one of the busiest times of the year. You're taking some risks, taking out these people on a trail where there's a lot of people coming and going. The hikers that we talked to said, you know, yeah, every couple of minutes they're passing somebody. Sometimes it's hard to be on the trail and not see somebody far ahead or far behind you. To think you're going to, and he did, he took out two people without anybody coming across him as he was doing this execution. What does that say? I mean, the risks are enormous in this.
Rage. So going from zero to 100, you're right. From our optic, from what we know, it's from his look of inexperience of having done this. Again, boy, you know, we can only draw upon what we've been recently covering. We've been covering Koberger so much. And from the onset, it went from zero to murder. From, in other words, they haven't murdered anyone before to murdering four. In this case, very similar. Haven't murdered anyone before, but murdering two. But what Koberger did for his arc, which I'm going to bet on this one. This guy's got a rage issue, and he's got an anger issue, because that's what's escalated in this guy's life. It looks like is he went from rage, anger, to can't contain it anymore. I'm going to go out on the hottest days possible, dress up in a lot of dark clothes and go kill someone because I'm so angry at this time. So most likely whether he's been arrested for it or talked to by law enforcement before or not, we don't know. But I guarantee you, if anyone's worked around this guy at work, he's the type of guy at work that's going to take offense really quick, really easy. He's going to get angry. He's going to be vindictive, and he's going to make your work life in a complete misery. And we all have known people like this that don't murder people. But if we want to start looking at laws of probability, of possibility, of other data points and people calling in tips, those are the kind of tips that I'm looking for when people are calling in. Someone in the workplace, especially a day or two leading up to this, because this does not look like a massive amount of planning. Mm-hmm. It looks like some planning. But if it was well planned and this individual was patient, they'd wait till the fall. They'd wait till where there's less people on the trail. There's other places to do this. If you're so vindictive against one individual, there's ways he could have done it where he would have been safer in the aftermath.
Does this in any way read to you like a meth addict or something of that nature?
Yeah,
out there, delusional, you know, thinking these people are out to get him, whatever delusion may be running through one's mind in that state, and this just happens to be the ones that he targeted. I mean, that's the easy explanation. That's the one I hear a lot of in around here. You know, outside of this metro area, you get into the sticks a bit in the state of Arkansas, you have a lot of meth problems. And that's the thing, that if you're not from the area, you're like looking at here, Arkansas. Well, Northwest Arkansas isn't one of those areas. It's a bubble unto itself. I've said this before. Walmart is headquartered here. It very much is a very desirable place to live. It's like Nashville. It's like a smaller Nashville. It's like a smaller Dallas. Very happy, very growing, very financially well off, I would say. Very stable economy, very low crime rates. It's not a place with a ton of drug problems in the immediate area. But again, you get off to the sticks, you do see a lot more of that going on. And Devil's Den is a bit out of town and just slightly out of the area, so you could certainly get that in there. But again, uncommon to see something like this happen for the amount of drug issues that this state has, even in the areas that are more drug riddled. We don't hear a lot about this sort of thing happening even over there.
It's, you know, everything's a possibility, and I wouldn't rule anything out.
Yeah.
But same time, though, in this case, I don't think it's in the moment that there's an issue with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be some in his system, but There's a lot of space he's got to cover. There was enough planning to say that someone wasn't completely incoherent and hopped up on drugs at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was enough planning. There's driving involved. He didn't crash into anything on the way out. Otherwise, we'd know. And the hiking part itself, he's actually targeting. So anytime you have something like this, some sort of abuse of alcohol or drugs is always, is 99% of times involved with the individual that committed the crime to begin with. So I think that's going to be a part of it in the end, whether it was part of it in this actual moment or not. Don't know. It's a lot of moving parts to pull off successfully and still be able to get away if he was severely under the influence at the moment, I would think.
And the part to me that I guess, pulls that down as being a probability of him being just a tweaker out there that's nuts and is the planning. Yeah, I mean, he came into this, his license plates taped off. It's a, from what we understand of the vehicle, it's not like some, it's not a Geo Metro he's escaping in, you know, or right. something that's, you know, some beater. It, from the account that we heard of the guy who saw the vehicle firsthand and also had the vehicle on his security camera footage. In fact, we can put that up here again for a second if people want to take a look at that.
Yeah.
This was, it wasn't like a, you know, a super cheap car. It was, from a lot of people are suggesting, it may be some sort of a luxury vehicle or somewhat of a sports car, maybe not top of the line, but I mean, Audi or an Acura, BMW, Mazda is the one that the authorities are saying right now. It seems to possibly resemble that the most. But again, the car guy that I talked to last night who took this exact video was not describing it as such. And there's a video for that on our channel if anybody wants to look at that in greater detail. But you have all of those factors. Typically, when you see the tweaker, you see the meth addict that's out there that's nuts. They're not pre-planning anything. It just happens to be in the moment. I've never heard of a meth addict that had the license plate taped off, ready to go, and had full tactical gear ready as they went off on the hiking trail, which I guess this guy would call it his hunting trail.
Yeah, I'm with you. So it took enough planning, but not too much planning is the best way I can kind of say it, because it took planning enough to try not to get caught, but at the same time, if he had exercised patience, he could have gotten away cleaner is a better way to put it, because he left a lot of data point and footprints along the way. It's hard to imagine us not getting him, but since law enforcement has been extremely tight-lipped, I mean, you're reporting more than law enforcement is on this one, which is kind of odd given the number of people that have captured him on video and captured him, you know, in a lot of areas. So it's hard to imagine him being on the lam for too much longer, I wouldn't think.
I want to talk about the law enforcement response to this. And I'm not trying to be critical, although I've had to be extremely critical over the last
days.
Because nothing was being fixed, nothing was being changed, and it drove me nuts.
The call-in number.
Oh my God. And our we have a lot of local viewers now and a lot of local listeners to this, because we've been basically the only one reporting on it, because local media hasn't done much. To put some context here, they put out a tip line. At 8 o'clock at night. Let me back up even a moment before that. This thing took place at about 1:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, the 26th of July, 2025. It wasn't until 8:30-ish at night that they finally put out a public bulletin stating, hey, by the way, there was a double homicide here at this hiking trail that you're all camping at, enjoying your day and barbecues and hot dogs and baked beans. Yeah, there's a family dead just down the way. Thought you should know 6 hours later. That to me was shocking. They were well aware of this. They knew there was two bodies there by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They finally came out with a statement that said, well, we had bad cell service, the terrain, and foliage. I'm sorry. It's not 1925. It's 2025. I get it. It's bad cell service out there. What the hell is going on that it took that many hours to let the public know this is going on? And I get, you know, you do want to keep some of this under wraps so you don't tip the guy off, but obviously he knows he's going to be looked for at this moment in time. And you have a lot of scared citizens and people who have a right to know that this guy is on the loose. It took forever to get any sort of information, just that much. And then the tip line they put out isn't working for 3 days. We called it. Hundreds of listeners called that damn thing and said, it just hangs up on you. So I get on the air, complain about it for 3 days, and finally they put out one that works and a website that people can go to. 3 days! The first 24 to 48 hours are the most important in any investigation, and they completely dropped the ball on it, giving these BS excuses of foliage. I get it. sometimes, like in the Koberger case, they knew who they were going after right away. And they didn't necessarily need to keep putting things out there. And it did look like they were dropping the ball. But sometimes they are truly dropping the ball. Right. They didn't have a sketch. They didn't have anything of this guy until I brought them the people that said they could identify the guy and give them a sketch, and then they finally got a sketch out. This should not be the job of a podcaster. This should be law enforcement doing this. What's going on behind the scenes?
In situations like that, the only thing I first go to is we got leadership with no reps.
Yeah.
You know, there's two possibilities, and there's lots of possibilities, but the only two things that really enter my mind is summer vacation or leadership with no reps or a combination of two.
Yeah.
Because when you drop the ball on these things, there are chiefs of police, there's law enforcement individuals that I know that would be able to, without batting an eyelash, just take charge, take command. I've been part of them where, like, all of a sudden you're just like, you're sitting back and watching the show. You're watching true leadership take command of the situation, the public information that gets out there. They got a process in place for that. They have a process in place for notifying locals, for notifying news organizations. They have, because they have experience in having done this before. I have not done any research on the law enforcement in the area here, how many sworn they have, don't have sworn. Yeah, I know I know there's issues sometimes when you're dealing with state parks and park police, and whether it's a national or a state park. I mean, so there's a lot of different jurisdiction types of issues that might have muddled this earlier on for this as well, which becomes confusing. And that's the only explanation I can come up with. But to your point, though, too, that's why I think shows like this and others and social media is really helping these cases. I mean, just look in the Koberger case. Who was one of the ones that was really feeding law enforcement early on? The dad of Maddie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, Stephen was going at it. You know, he's the one who provided, you know, the investigators in Moscow, you know, the video from the Grubhub truck.
Yeah.
You know, and so, sometimes it takes a kick in the ass.
That's what it seems. I mean, it shouldn't have to. And I guess that's the shocking part. I don't know why I'm shocked by it all the time, but because it's like, I think we sometimes have this idea of our institutions that they're going to work, they're going to function as planned, but that's not always the case. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's just having to be held accountable because somebody's watching them and they can't just do business as usual of, well, here's how we handle things here. Well, guess what? This is something you have to handle a little bit different because public safety is a key factor here. I mean, again, this is a hiking community. This is what people do here.
Right.
And now you have this whole area being very, very cautious of getting out on any of these trails because the guy is at large. We don't know much about him. Is this someone who's trying to be turned into a serial killer? We don't know the answer to that. We don't know, was this targeted? It's just all up in the air. But when they respond back with such BS answers like cell service, foliage, the terrain. The terrain, Bill. Tell him it's the terrain. I mean, come on.
Here's why you shouldn't have heard that. The reason you shouldn't have heard that, or anyone shouldn't hear that, is because what you're supposed to do in law enforcement as a first responder is rehearsals. You rehearse and plan out every possible contingency that you can think of in your area of operation. Now, you're not going to capture them all, but you're then going to create a standard operating procedure for X, for Y. Mm-hmm. And that's why schools do active shooter drills. That's why they do them at universities. That's why they have fire drills. That's why we do all these different things to practice these contingencies. What happens is when we see the great departments that have a great response, all of a sudden they're on it. You know, they're telling, hey, we're going to do a press briefing at this time, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here's why we can't tell you, here's what we do tell you. Because it's not their first rodeo. It might be their first live experience, but they've done the rehearsals, they've gotten in training reps. Mm-hmm. What this shows me is they did not have any training reps for a contingency of someone being either seriously injured or murdered on their trails.
Is that excusable? Because it's a good thing they don't have reps in real life because that means this doesn't happen here very often. But there should be some sort of training reps, like you just said. Or, training is training. Real life is real life. And the two are very different. I guess, have some grace here on this or call it out and say, do better.
I think where it depends on where they go from here. So let's go to the behaviors of trust. So now we'll go to my area, which I love. And so the behaviors of trust are open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. And so we want open, honest communication from them. We want the honesty of what happened and what's going to move forward from here. And the big thing is the vulnerability. And what I mean by vulnerability, are they going to own their missteps? And are they going to tell you what they're doing to correct those missteps and not just tell you the words, but take the action? So I know what we're all doing now is we're taking a deep breath and we're watching what's going to change from this point forward. Are they going to start doing a change? Are they going to double down on stupid? That's what is going to really going to, because when you double down on the behaviors you've done, and so here's what the challenge happens sometimes. I guarantee this is happening. Behind the scenes on the law enforcement side, you have them, there's a probability, not guarantee, but a probability they're moaning, bitching, and complaining about guys like you and me that are blasting them for not doing more because in their minds they're doing more. Okay, so let's take it for granted that they're doing more than we know about, which I guarantee they are. But the problem is this, the public perception is that they're not. Mm-hmm. And when you have to have a public perception that gives trust and faith in an organization, where if you want to be the sump of information where it should all the information should be going to law enforcement first and foremost so they can get data points so they can capture this guy and bring justice, mm-hmm. right? But if no one trusts them because of public perception, no matter how that public perception was created, that's on them.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Continue, please.
Yeah, because here's the alternative. That when the public doesn't trust the institution, what are they going to do? They're going to go to you. They're going to go to other podcasters and true crime people to pass the information to because they're trusting us to do something with it. And we're going to do something with it. But the problem is we're not law enforcement. And so we become when people become the in-between because no one trusts the law enforcement because they have a public perception of not taking the action they need to take – that's on law enforcement. They got to do something. Whether they think it's true or not behind the scenes, it doesn't matter because that's a public opinion.
Well, and that's the reality is you can think it's not true all you want back there in law enforcement. It's true. It doesn't matter. Do better. That's what I've been saying the whole time. That's what I said on Banfield last night. Do better. We're not trying to be your enemy. We're not trying to hinder your investigation. We're trying to help you. But when the public witnesses come to me after trying to get a hold of you for days and can't, and the answer is, just keep trying. And I hear, well, there's other lines too. That's not, people don't jump through hoops. Put something out there that works.
Here's the critical thing to keep in mind. So then put yourself in the mind of people that have valuable information. If the people that have valuable information are saying this, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do with it. Yeah. That means you failed.
Yeah. And I've also heard from several people who have brought fairly valid tips to them, getting dismissed directly on the phone, like immediately, without even like looking at the data or the information that they're presenting. And I take a look at it going, yeah, there should be a couple eyeballs on this, especially some suspicious online activity that's been out there that we have seen that should have some eyes on it. There seems to be that attitude as well. And I've heard that from several people who now finally have gotten a hold of somebody. And then we didn't think it's it. I don't know. I'm not feeling good about this investigation.
And so this is so important too. So regardless, because again, it's easy to go down the road and I do this when I'm thinking about this. Well, maybe they already know who this guy is.
Maybe.
They just can't find him yet. But here's the problem with that. Good. But if the people that want to keep helping are discouraged from keeping helping, then whether it's this case or the next case, they're going to figure, what's the use?
Exactly. When you're dismissed, when you're bringing valuable information, at least what you perceive as being valuable information, and you're just kind of poo-pooed out there, which is what is happening in this case. And again, maybe they already know the answers to some of these questions, but you can't tell the people that are coming to you to F off, basically. And I know they didn't say that verbatim, but that's the perception that a lot of people are getting. I've heard directly from them. That doesn't encourage people to share with you when it's already a five-ring circus they have to jump through just to talk to somebody.
The most important thing when you are in a position like law enforcement is when you rely on the village. It takes a village to do all these things. The most important thing is the people is for your public that's bringing you information either this time or the next time when something tragic happens is for you to validate them and their actions. Yeah. And you do that by saying, hey, I got to tell you what, that was a very valuable tip you just called in. Thank you very much. We're going to take it. We're going to put it over there for everything else we got. If you have anything else or you know anyone else, either now or in the future, please come to me. Thank you very much.
And there are good people out there in it. I've talked to several of them in the course of this investigation that have said to me, look, if you have anybody and they can't get through, here's my number. Have them call me directly. And I have passed that along. But again, that's not how this should be run. Most people are not going to have that interaction, and I'm not going to be talking to most of them or even know about them. So they're not going to know to get that number. It's a cluster. They got to make it easy.
Got to make it easy to be a help.
Exactly. Exactly.
And now, granted, and I get it. I was in FBI New York, and right after 9/11, worked 9/11 in New York City, and that whole mess and tragedy. And after that, we had the anthrax scare.
Yeah.
And I worked tip lines when the anthrax scare. And I'll tell you, the most challenging thing ever is being our 800 operators, which I was setting on those phones for a while, because you get a lot of crazy crackpots, you know, calling in stuff like, oh my gosh, someone's shooting missiles at a building I'm listening to this stuff. And the first time you're listening to the crazy, you're like, wow, really? And all of a sudden you're realizing, oh, that's a crazy. So you got to filter.
Yeah.
But at the same time though, it's very challenging because you have to validate everyone. And that takes what? It takes bandwidth, it takes effort, it takes time, it takes some training, and it takes a lot of energy away from, you know, if you're a limited small force, a small number of people. I mean, listen to the beautiful 911 caller that you were chatting with. You know, they had three callers on that day. It's not a lot of callers, you know, for a lot of information coming in. So you can understand the challenge at the beginning if they weren't ready.
Mm-hmm.
But from this point forward, they need to really get on the ball really rapidly. So people have trust and faith in the system.
You know, it takes all of those things without a doubt, but what it takes more than anything else is just a little bit of empathy. And that doesn't take hours. It doesn't take tons of people. It takes the approach. It takes, when you do get that interaction, to have a little empathy for that person who is fearful for their safety and they're trying to protect their community and they're trying to bring you information. And what they get is a go away.
Where's the briefings? Where's the briefings?
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. We are now, this is what, Wednesday? Is it Wednesday? I believe so. This happened on Saturday. There has been no press conference. There's been a couple tweets and a couple PDFs that have been released. No press conference on any of this to reassure the public, say anything about this. Maybe we have a lead, maybe we don't. Just something.
Most of my data I get when doing my initial assessments on cases like this are from watching the chief brief it.
We don't even have that.
And it doesn't even, because it always gives me so much understanding of what's going on behind the scenes, because it's easy to see whether they got their finger on the pulse, whether they don't. You can tell by the tempo of their delivery. You can tell by how they're taking questions on whether they're on their shit or not.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's been every single case we covered. The first thing I go for is I'm waiting for the briefing.
Yeah.
Because I want to see them, because that's going to tell me the depth of field they have and the experience they have in covering cases like this, as well as how much they have their pulse on this one, regardless of what they're willing to give out to the public or not. So for everyone listening, that's what you're looking for. Not necessarily what they can say or not say because of the investigation. That's great. I'm looking for competence in delivery. I'm looking for congruence in the things they're saying, that they say we're confident we're going to get them. And emotionally, do they feel it? You're going to be able to pick up on these things. So that's what we're not getting here. That's why we're in a lot of blind spots still right now on this. It's kind of shocking, actually.
Which is very important. You have a community. There's like a million plus people in this area. We're not, you know, a small little town. And even if you were, you would still want to communicate. The fact that is not happening at all. It seems to be such a blind spot. Now, I'll eat crow. If they find this guy and they already have him in their sights and they're just waiting for the right time or whatever, and great, wonderful, behind the scenes, maybe you got it covered. Your job is to keep your community, even if you're not, don't have him in your sights, informed and aware and feeling that the community feeling you are competent in your job. The community does not feel that they're being competent in their job right now.
So this town, Tony, help me understand. Yeah. Is this town run by a town supervisor, mayor, and happen to know?
This is out in Washington County. It is, I don't know the exact jurisdiction because it's outside of Fayetteville. So it's now being headed up by the state police with the FBI now providing assistance out of Little Rock.
Because I would think at this point, though, whoever's the elected official that runs this area, why are they not poking at law enforcement or any of themselves coming out and having a presser? That's what's kind of shocking. Is like, all right, so if law enforcement falls down for X, Y, and Z, because maybe, you know, hey, you know, worst case scenario, it's summer. Maybe the chief is on vacation. It was just a conglomeration of really worst case scenarios coming together. Well, that's why you actually have checks and balances with the elected officials now holding someone accountable, if not themselves, to get up there and let's have a brief, man.
I'm sick of excuses with people, with all of it. There's no excuses. It's like, okay, they're on vacation. Well, then get his ass back here as quickly as he can.
Yes.
If not, until then, the one who's in, it's not like there's nobody in charge. It's not just like, well, you guys do your thing. We get back. We'll do what we do. I mean, someone, like, in lieu of the chief not being here, and talk with the chief when he's on vacation and figure out what your message is going to be and get it out there. You can't just send out a PDF when there's a double homicide in a community and there's kids and people. I mean, this is a horrific horror story, and it's seemingly utterly tone deaf from the authorities. This is why you thankfully have private media, podcasters, myself, all the others who are beginning to cover this as well.
Keeping them accountable, because Tony, here's what where I go on the behavioral side of this, we're seeing data points lining up of chaos.
Yeah.
In other words, who the hell is leading?
I don't know. I'm all over this story. I have no idea.
No, so my next thing jumps to, what the hell's going on in this town? You know, that no one is actually, you know, so my brain starts going to, all right, so we had a horrendous situation here, which in normal, healthy, you know, government politics, law enforcement life should be handled like X, Y, and Z. And it's completely vacant. And generally when things are completely vacant, you know, your brain fills it with, there must be chaos. So someone's got to tell me why there's not chaos. Because right now I'm thinking this thing looks like a crap show to me.
And if the answer is that's not our job, you're wrong. It is.
Oh,
that
yeah,
is your
that's
job.
Not the answer.
That is exactly
it's someone's job.
Your
make
job.
It your job.
Exactly.
Because you know what? If you make it your job, you're now the person in charge.
I feel like Gordon Ramsay going in here and like, oh my God, what's in your freezer?
You know, so I know I've probably said it to you before. One of the greatest expressions that really helped me as a young Marine Corps officer was, and because there's no standard operating procedure for chaos.
No.
A standard operating procedure gets you to the line of embarkation. And all of a sudden, like you said before, when the fog of war hits, now you just have to move forward. And the expression was simply, what now, Lieutenant? You know, you're brand new second lieutenant and chaos hits. And when you're constantly looking around, no, everyone's looking to you. What now, Lieutenant? What are you going to do now? And so no one so far is stepping up and saying, I got it.
Yeah. Hopefully that changes. Hopefully that gets
back on the
track.
Exactly. Someone has to.
Well, we'll keep doing it.
Because you have two little girls that are without a mom and a dad right now.
And they deserve
looking for
answers.
Yeah. And you have a community wondering what the hell's next. And you have, and we've seen it. You've talked to beautiful, amazing people on your show, you know, from the 911 callers to the other witnesses that were just there looking to be a help, looking, you know, they're the villagers saying, hey, where's our village leader? We can actually do something about this.
Be good to see one stand up. Washington County, Arkansas State Police, somebody. I know Arkansas State Police is the lead on this.
Tony for mayor.
Do better.
Tony for mayor.
Do better. My God. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and author of this book, Unbreakable Alliances, available wherever books are sold. Thank you, as always, for being on with us.
Always.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.